Hey, podcast listeners, you're listening to a recording made on the 27th of July, 2015. And that's different from the date you're about to hear. That's a date for broadcast listeners, whereas you are part of the podcast listening elite. And by the way, please tell all your friends about us. Also, thank you for downloading. This is Geek Speak for Saturday, August 1st, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the studio is Brian Young, a CG artist, iOS developer, and lifelong tinkerer.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Brian. Also, Lyle Troxell, a JavaScript enthusiast and Higgs boson ball tosser.
Hello.
That one's, I believe,
a confusing one. That'll get people thinking for a while.
Well, should we have a contest? What does that mean, you guys?
I think regular listeners will recall that I named my dog Higgs boson.
Well, they will now.
They will.
So the ball always comes back to you, right?
Because
the gravity's there.
The gravity force is amazing in that dog.
Lots to talk about today.
You know, we could talk more about that dog. It is an amazing dog.
What about that dog?
I love my dog. That's all.
All right. We want to follow up on a follow-up.
Oh, yes, Bonnie. So at what point does follow-up of a follow-up become a regular story that we cover every week on Geek Speak?
The follow-up section? Yeah, I don't know. In a segment we like to call follow-ups.
So over the past few weeks, I've covered a few stories about ad blockers and ad blocking coming to iOS and and many other ad blocking related stories. But there's one thing that I wanted to bring up because we never talked about it directly. One of the biggest offenders to the web page loading, slow loading times is actually the tracking code that's being put onto the web page. This JavaScript code that's being run, that it never actually creates an ad, it never actually creates anything that you see on the page, but it's sending data about your browser and about you back to the ad company so they can deliver more targeted ads to you that are going to be helpful, right?
To you, yes.
Yeah. I'm not so sure the targeting has ever helped anybody, but these ad trackers, they really do take up a lot of the load time and generate a lot of load time. Mm-hmm. And there are tools out there that you can use that'll help you. One of the ones I hear about all the time is Ghostery. Do you guys use Ghostery?
We've mentioned Ghostery before on the show.
I've used it a while. It got distracting. It has this it tracks basically what a web page opens and loads, and then shows you kind of links, and it blocks them by default, and you can kind of click on them and say open them up. But it looks like a big it's done in a graphical form, so it's kind of fun to look at.
So there's an interesting business model that they do. Did you remember when you installed Ghostery whether it asked you whether you wanted to send information back to Ghostery, anonymous information?
I did not install it. I used it on a friend's computer because I wanted to try it out, but I didn't install it. But,
did you do that? Have you tried that?
No, I actually haven't used Ghostery. That's part of the reason why I was asking you. But
our illustrious design geek, Al Luckow, uses it regularly. So we could ask him if he wasn't touring the country, Italy, I think.
Some other country.
Yeah, lucky him.
Yeah. Mm. All right. So thinking about Ghostery. You're thinking of ways to speed up the load time.
So I want to say right off the bat that I think Ghostery is a good tool and it's useful. But you should know that you will be asked whether you want to return anonymous data about yourself, about your browser, to Ghostery, and Ghostery uses that to sell that data back to ad networks.
Hey.
They say they're not tracking you for the purpose of showing you target ads. What they're trying to do is trying to give data to the ad companies about what kind of people are actually blocking the ads, who is not going to want to see the ads.
That seems exactly opposite of the goal of Ghostery.
Yeah. So we're going to include a link on GeekSpeak.
It's like a shadow goal.
You can read Ghostery's response to this.
Yeah, I bet it was interesting.
Yeah. I actually think their business model while it sounds a little shady, it holds up when you listen to what the founder of Ghostry said. Yeah,
I can see that it's kind of an interesting idea. Like, clearly users don't want to be tracked and be targeted in this way. And so the user base that's using Ghostry is that user base. And if advertisers understood that better, then they wouldn't be doing that practice because, of course, they're losing those customers. So in some ways, it's a way to have a feedback mechanism back to the advertisers.
Exactly, exactly. The people that are going to use this are not the people that are going to buy something that they're selling.
Just to be clear, Ghostry, when you install it, really does allow you to manage how your machine interacts with the internet. And it can help you be more private.
Yeah. So the reason why I haven't used Ghostry is 3 or 4 years ago, another tool came out, which I have used ever since, called Disconnect. Oh. And they have an entirely different business model, though their goal is basically the same thing, to block these trackers. And it is not at all invasive. It's just a little toolbar app shows up in Safari. They have it for all the browsers. Mm-hmm. And when you go to a site, you just see this number tally up of all the different trackers on that page that it has blocked and kept from getting information on you. And the way they do their business model is they have a premium service which allows you to do the same thing on Android or iOS on a mobile browser. Mm-hmm. And they also have a VPN service that they bundle into that. So if you wanted to be more anonymous, if you wanted to not appear like you're coming from your own home network or your work network, but somewhere else that's mysterious that the trackers really can't figure out who you are from, Disconnect premium service that you pay for is a good way to do that. That's $50 a year.
Ouch.
But their free version for desktop browsers works great.
Uh-huh. And of course, we're not endorsing that. We're not doing commercial radio here. It's just something.
Really? Because I was just about to
Ryan's
say
suggestion.
You know, if you're recruiting for ISIS, you might want to check out Disconnect. All right. That was just a joke, everyone listening in.
You know, Ben is traveling the world. We mentioned that he's a world traveler all the time, and he's currently traveling around the world.
The world, actually doing the world traveling.
Doing the world traveling, which
and
means...
my God, he described his itinerary, and he's literally going all over the place.
Yeah, he really is.
Every place.
I don't think he's hitting
Antarctica. And all over every place.
Yeah, it's impressive. Yep. But that means we have a little bit of a light load on space news, because normally Ben covers space news.
But we do still have space news.
I do. I have
there
one.
There has been some tremendous space news.
Absolutely.
I hear we found a Class M planet.
Well, I love that you said Class M planet. You are a geek.
I am a geek.
Class M, you know what Class M means, of course, Brian.
Am I wearing a red shirt?
No, that's good. Class M
that's
is
why you're
a designation
here.
By the Star Trek universe on what a planet is by inhabitable by humanoids. Mm-hmm. Mostly, basically, you know, all aliens in
everything
that universe
that
is humanoid, unless you're a giant amoeba.
Hey, except for the rocks. The rocks were not
except
humanoid.
The rocks, yeah.
And the giant, you know, amoeba creatures that kill planets. Mm-hmm. But anyway,
Kepler
is a space telescope in orbit that searches for planets around other suns, not our sun, but other suns. And they do that by using the Doppler mechanism of the wobble and warble of the sun that's being targeted, or the star that's being targeted. And recently, 452b was found, and it is about 60 times larger than Earth. 60%, sorry, not times. That would be too big.
Yowza.
60% larger than Earth.
Yeah, it used to be we'd always find planets that are 60 times larger than Earth, and that was the big
that's
story.
That's why I said that, exactly. No. This is only 60% larger, so it's pretty much comparable to Earth. You could stand on it. Its gravitational force wouldn't destroy your ankles, but it would be harder to move around. It's located from here. The star is located from here 14,000 light years from our planet. So this
that's
does
pretty
not,
close.
From all perspective of usefulness, it's completely not close at all. But it is in the Milky Way, which is kind of cool. The sun, so the sun is about 10% brighter than our star and 4% larger. But basically, because of the distance that the planet is from, it's very much the environment is very much like our environment.
They hang out kind of like the sun hangs out with the Earth.
Yeah, it's in what's called the Goldilocks range, where you know it's not too hot and it's not too cold.
It's just right.
So it's kind of exciting, and it's very possible that that could support us, assuming that there's actually water.
We can get to it.
We can't get to it. I mean, the idea of getting to it's just ludicrous with our current understanding of physics.
But part of the reason why we're looking for these is not to find another habitable planet for ourselves, but it's where we expect to find life could be there now.
Are we alone?
And this is the first time we have found an Earth-sized world, and this is comparable Earth-sized world, that is in the habitable zone of a sun that's similar to ours. So it's really kind of exciting.
That's
kind of
cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so now there's at least two of us, and if there are two of us...
There's billions and billions and billions.
There must be many more.
Definitely.
That's very exciting. Yay. Well, let's go into something equally universe-shattering. The iOS public beta and App Store reviews.
we're jumping around all over the place.
Absolutely, completely useless.
So I just wanted to bring something up since we're trying to make geekdom understandable to the rest of humanity. So
bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity.
Yes, I totally butchered that. But
no, you did fine.
So I got a question for you. You all know the answer to this. Who all makes the apps on your phone?
Developers.
So for like an Apple phone, it's Apple developers, right? They all work for the company, right?
No, it's a lot of individual.
That's how we're supposed to make our next million. I thought we're all going to make apps
and just make
our money.
A new Miss Pac-Man that isn't breaking the trademark and make a buttload.
Okay, so there's all these independent developers out there. Some of them are big companies. Some of them are just one-person shops living on an island in Tahiti. And, oh, that would be so great.
But we see Brian's focus.
It's a magical place.
Some of them are large corporations, like Netflix, for example.
Yeah. And where
I work on the iOS app. Right?
By the way.
To be clear how I brought it up.
And they all survive by making money on the App Store because it's the only place you can sell an iOS app. And recently...
Wait a second. Sorry. Since I brought up Netflix, we don't actually sell the app on the App Store. It's free on the App Store.
Oh,
so there's
other
business models also for businesses to have apps on the App Store. But yes, selling them or putting advertising on there is a big way independent developers make money on the App Store.
Yeah. Of course, you could make money through services that you sell separately and download the app from the App Store. Mm-hmm. But what I was trying to get to is that there's... for the first time, been a beta iOS operating system program. So anybody in the public, not just developers, can download the beta version of the next iOS that has not yet come out yet.
And which is called iOS 9. Their apps.
Yeah.
Well, the developers can prepare their apps.
That's what I meant.
But the thing is, that's been available for a long time for developers that are kind of in the know and actually pay money to Apple to be able to get it early. They release it normally at WWDC. And... then you get to run it locally, and you're under a non-disclosure agreement. And it's a very private thing. You're supposed to be careful about it. But what you're saying this year, Brian, is it's a lot more open.
Yeah.
Is it literally open source?
No, not open source. What it is since the public can now download the beta version of iOS 9, they can see what the new features are going to be like. They can test it out. And the motivation for a company like Microsoft does this, motivation for Apple to do this, is to get it tested by more people out in the public to find out all those glitches that traditionally Apple doesn't find out until the first week that they release it.
Why should we have to test our stuff if we can have other people do it for us?
Well, they've got a problem. Most of the people that have been testing their operating system happen to be developers that are in the company, or if they're lucky, other developers out of the company. And, you know, developers just don't use the devices the same way a normal person does.
Oh.
Hey, what are you trying to say, man?
Yeah, we're not normal.
Oh, okay. Weirdos.
So, but what I wanted to bring up here...
So now, what are the normal people doing with the iOS 9?
Well, okay, so normal people would put the beta on their phone, and they'd use their apps. And when the app crashes, they're going to get frustrated.
They'll go, hey.
And they're going to go to the App Store.
Yeah.
And they're going to give it a bad rating.
The app?
Yeah.
No, the operating system is bad, not the app.
No, but the app's the one that crashed.
Oh, no. Is that what's been going on?
Yes. So that's been going on for the time since, I think it's been a few weeks since the beta was released. And
the
developers who make their living on the App Store were screaming about this, that this is not fair.
This is
not right.
Right.
Well,
of course,
not.
They all are hopefully running the beta as well and testing their app and fixing their app so that it works with the beta. Yeah.
Yeah, but so what I just wanted to point out is this was going on, and now they've closed that loophole. You can't now put a rating on an app in the App Store if you've got the beta OS on your phone. But I think this highlights more what is important to know for the general public of who's writing these apps.
Well, and it seems like a little bit of a missed connection there when Apple was putting this out to their benefit, not to have a clearer way, I guess, for people who are using it to communicate with them about
things
that are funky.
There's disclosures and agreements that you click through when you do this.
But it's a very simple thing for them to say, you're using a beta operating system, and therefore, no, we're not going to allow you to rate apps on the App Store because it's beta. That makes sense.
And that's what they've done now. Good. And that's fair for the developers. And it still gives people a chance to test them out and give feedback to Apple.
Right. Well, let me just reassure you that we here at GeekSpeak love being communicated with about your experience of the show, whether it is your technical experience of the show or the content of the show. You can join us online at on Twitter or Facebook. We are KUSP Geeks, and we would love to hear from you. If you've got questions or corrections or follow-ups, you can reach out to us online, KUSP Geeks. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. We'll be right back. You're listening to Geek Speak on KOSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me is Brian Young and Lyle Troxell, and we're going to talk about some ethical things. Let's start off. Well, okay, last week, Lyle, you mentioned the Nightmare Death Machine drone with some automatically firing weapons.
Some idiot that put a handgun on top of a drone and flew it around and fired at the same time.
Super scary.
And of course, that's a homegrown thing.
Yeah.
But we have these things in the military happening right now, drones that are actually killing people with missiles. Hmm. And of course, none of those are manned vehicles, meaning there's a human being somewhere, normally far, far away, that's controlling this vehicle and deciding when to kill things.
Right.
People. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, this is about something kind of different.
Okay.
Drones in general are amazing, right? They're these light aircraft that can fly around. Sometimes they're propelled by multiple copter things. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes they're actually like planes. And there's an interesting project by Timothy Chung. He's the person working on it at the Naval Postgraduate School, working on swarming these things. So you basically take a whole bunch of drones, you put them in the air, and you give them enough brains to follow each other. So they act as a swarm. Now, swarming code is really fun. Like swarming in general, the idea of it's really cool. If you look at a flock of birds that make a triangular form, you know, the standard geese flying south, that form is generated because for them over time, that shape makes sense to them. The front bird cuts the wind, and then they can ride in the wake.
And back in the day, this was a fun sort of puzzle to crack for animators.
Yeah, right. So, well, then there's this other technique of swarming where when a whole bunch of creatures come together in a swarm, like a bee swarm or a fish swarm, popular in Finding Nemo, right, Brian?
Yeah,
did you work on Finding Nemo?
I did.
What did you do in Finding Nemo?
I did a lot of lighting, especially in the tiki tank.
Oh, the underwater lighting. Oh, yeah. That's kind of cool.
Fantastic.
So swarming in that sense was you get, I think, the fish that interacts with Dory, who helps them out, or the fishes, as I will, act as one.
Yeah, yeah. I remember the guy who was doing these special effects on that. And he was having it was a lot of work just to make those fish make shapes as they're swimming around. Because the trick is the fish have to all act as one and go in a certain direction, but there isn't necessarily one leader.
Right. And that's the thing that's interesting about a swarm. When you program it, you kind of get it to, they all have slight rules, and together they operate as one unit. But the rules themselves are very simple, that no one's planning it or organizing it, which is kind of cool. This research is actually starting with one being a leader and they're all following, which of course is kind of the initial state, because the idea is later on, anyone could become a leader at any point and the swarm would move depending on different rules. So it's kind of a neat idea. So that kind of AI in flight and autonomous vehicles is coming, and it's kind of cool. Is that good, Bunny?
Yeah, that's good. But, you know, I'm thinking about that in combination with the thing from last week.
Yeah,
that can be scary. Scary military drone thing. So,
well, it wasn't military last week.
No, but you could put
handguns on all of them.
Yeah, you could. There, it could be bad.
Yes, it could be bad.
We have the technology to do some very, very scary things.
Well, let's bring it back around a little bit different way here. I mean, yeah, that's scary to think of somebody using these drones as a weapon, but we've proven pretty well that we're not very good at securing any of our electronics. So there's a really big news story this week where couple of researchers proved that they could take over just a regular old 2015 Jeep, and not even being anywhere near it from being anywhere on the internet, anywhere in the world, they could take over this Jeep and control its brakes, control its acceleration, control its windshield wipers, and its entertainment system.
Recall right now.
Yeah. So this is a really big, scary thing in the news that they're talking about. But there are some things we need to be aware of, that why not everybody who's driving around right now is going to have their car taken over.
Right.
It's really interesting story in the sense that here they are, these researchers, that their motivation is they're going to go to this big conference every year where they show off their research about the cool thing that they've hacked into.
It's their hacker cred.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the one coming up is Black Hat. Is that correct?
I can't recall. I'm sorry.
Yeah. That is one.
Yeah. So sounds all sinister. Black Hat, I know. But so they want to show off their research. And they've been working on this for a while, where they were just trying to affect the car by getting into proximity and tweaking something in the electronics and being able to take over that way. But they realized that the infotainment system is connected to the cell phone that is in these cars. Now, this particular hack is apparently specialized enough that you have to have a certain upgrade for them to be able to do the hack. But
so it's basically done in preparation for one of these conferences.
Yeah, for one of these conferences. And the knowledge on how to do this is not generally known. Only the researchers have it right now.
But it's caused a gigantic recall.
And the recall is up to 1.4 million cars.
From a whole bunch of different Jeeps, right?
Yeah, well, it's Fiat Chrysler cars. So we've got Jeeps in there. There's also some other ones like a Dodge Viper, Dodge Challenger, and Ram pickup. And it's a flaw in the way that the electronic infotainment system talks to the cell phone system, and eventually they can get into the other systems. Mm-hmm. So there is a patch for this. Some cars have even been updated over the air.
Yeah.
But more importantly...
through the means they were actually able to hack.
Yeah,
right?
Well, here's the funny thing. More cars can be hacked over the air than can be fixed over the air.
Right.
So...
Theoretically. I mean, the thing is that this kind of cracking of car tech is not uncommon. In fact, you know, in 2013, there were stories of people being near a car and cracking to the system through the Bluetooth or through other means. Mm-hmm. But this one is weird in that you said the cell phone, the car. My car also has a cell phone. I have a Leaf. And the reason it has a cell phone service is that it reports back to the company, and there's a website on the company where I can actually check to see if my car is charging or how much charge it has or where it is. And it's kind of like the OnStar protocol kind of thing.
Yeah.
But now it's kind of ubiquitous at some level. You just get this service that has a cell phone. That cell phone, of course, to be connected to the internet, has an IP address. And unfortunately, the way that they've implemented this infrastructure is that IP address is findable. So you can scan for that IP address, and then you have access to that car's internet protocol address, which, of course, is unique to the vehicle. And then, of course, the protocols on top of that weren't so great. So they could hack into it. Yeah. But it's kind of creepy that it used to be that, wow, we've got a computer, and if you get someone close enough and they're next to you and all that, that's one level of concern. But remote, completely remote, is a totally different ballgame.
Yeah, it sounds like a nightmare, and it is. If this becomes generally known, it is a nightmare. So,
well, they're fixing it.
They're fixing it, but not everybody takes a car into be serviced. They don't take in their car in for recalls, so they don't expect the vast majority of these to get fixed quickly.
This just reminds me.
Excuse me. Yeah. Are we in the panic section?
No panic.
No. I bring this up, and it sounds really scary, but I want to talk about the larger topic of. Companies need to be able to secure their technology. They need to figure out how to build these things without making huge security holes that are going to be that panic.
Well, and this is
scenario.
Sort of the role that hackers in general say that they are performing. Like, look, I'm finding out what your vulnerabilities are so you can make a stronger product.
Yeah.
Yeah, the hackers are not to blame here. They're just finding the problem and pointing it out. It's like going and seeing that, oh, wow, that building has a crack in the foundation. I should go tell somebody. Like, that's all it is. It just happens to take a lot of skill to do that kind of inspection. But the issue really is at hand is that we're not putting the kind of security in place that's necessary. But I want to bring back this idea that it's accessed via the internet is a very different kind of problem. And the Internet of Things is a totally different level. Because right now, if you were to visit my home, if you came over to my house and you looked around and stuff, after a period of time, you could probably find a way to like get into my house, right? Or maybe, you know, even if you went to the back bedroom or something and found that, oh, well, they don't have a glass safety here. They don't have a glass alarm system on the wall, on the window here. So if I got a ladder and broke the window on the second floor, I could get into the house and then I'd have free reign. Like that idea of there's a vulnerability in my house, security, right? Mm-hmm. But to know it and deal with it, you have to once, you know, be in California and then be in the mountains of Santa Cruz and then have to know my address and have to be there. You have to get a ladder, you have to be invited in. Like, there's all these precautions that make it, well, the percentage of people who actually be able to do that on the planet is really minuscule. Like, nobody. Only people I know.
Whereas if I could just sit at my house and scan the entire world for everybody that has Lyle set up.
That's the problem, is that ability for an automated system to find the problem and then spread that's why computer viruses are so tricky. Because it's not like somebody's doing it. It's somebody's writing something that then automatically does it. It's a propagation system. So it'd be trivial for these researchers to write a virus that would take these cars offline or do something more drastic, like when they reach 60 miles an hour, do something bad, right?
Would you say that wouldn't be hard to do. Protecting the security of the Internet of Things, for instance, would be a moral thing to do for that reason?
Well, I don't know about moral, but...
Would it be for the community good?
I don't like the idea of prescribing ethical, moral dilemmas on a company. I don't think companies should be thought of that way.
Okay.
Because if you think of a company as a moral thing, it's a psychopath, right? It's not a human being.
Yeah, it's depressing is what you're saying.
Yeah, totally.
but companies, anybody who's going to use or put out a product, which is this connected technology, they've got to really think about the security. And there are some very basic things in this story that are just appalling. Mm-hmm. So there's a basic network inside all of these cars. And when you make a network and you put on that network both the infotainment system and the cell phone radio and the brakes and the accelerator and the door locks all on the same system, and even though you say, no, we've made it so that one can't talk to the other, what these researchers did was they reprogrammed one part of that system that could then talk to the rest of them. So manufacturers should be thinking about this and saying, no, even though it saves money to make one network, we really should have two networks that are completely separate from each other and some very, very, very secure way for the infotainment system to talk to the other system just to read basic things.
Okay. And I guess, you know, Brian, the good news about this, if there is a good news, is that because of this massive recall, this company is getting hit by a lot of expense. And so everybody out there that's doing cars of this nature is going to go, we better fix this before we have to do that. Because a recall is not a cheap thing to do.
Yeah, it's not. What I wish is these older industry, the car industry, the light bulb and thermostat industry that are now making smart light bulbs and smart thermostats, I wish they would actually look to the computer companies, the software makers of the world, and really draw on their experience. It seems like, it feels like you need to have a Apple or a Google come in and make a old industry product before you get the security figured out well.
Those number of brains, that amount of wisdom in the crowd.
Yeah, well, there's certain incentives and certain things that shape a company. And the computer companies have been dealing with security ever since the mid-90s when Microsoft got hit so hard. And they've grown up with this. But the car companies, they may move slowly. And they may be cautious, but they don't have the mindset to look for the security problems. But this is a nice cautionary tale about cars and multiple networks in with cars. But there's also something that you can do at home, because everybody at home has a Wi-Fi network, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, Microsoft has a new technology that they allow you to share your Wi-Fi passwords through your social network.
Why? That seems like such a bad idea.
Well, no, it's great. You go over to your friend's house and he's already said, yeah, I want to share this with my social network friends. And when you go over to their house, you're automatically on their Wi-Fi network. Isn't that great?
Wait,
what kind
terrible.
Of social network?
I believe they're using Facebook.
No. I'm friends with on Facebook can have access to my Wi-Fi network?
Well, I believe in Windows 8 this was optional, but on Windows 10, about to come out in a week, it's going to be on by default.
Wow. The way so I understand. If you connect your Windows 10 operating system with
a social network,
Facebook,
yeah,
then your Facebook friends can have access to your network. Now, that's useful in some ways.
It sounds really useful. It's called Wi-Fi Sense, but there's a basic problem that maybe you wanted to keep something secure on your network and you forgot that you shared it with your particular friend that's coming over that isn't so well-intentioned, or maybe his phone has some particular virus on it that's spreading malware. There's many scenarios where you could see this being a problem in the future. So we at home can do the same thing to protect ourselves. We can have guest networks and private networks, where private networks just for our family, and guest networks when our friends come over. And maybe that's the password that you let be shared.
The thing that's interesting, of course, is that the passwords that you have in your keychain of sorts that's for Wi-Fi networks, none of them is like the computer doesn't necessarily know which is your home. So if you have like 15 different Wi-Fi passwords in your network, like I have your Wi-Fi, home Wi-Fi password, because I've been to your house, and so I added it to my computer when I was there one night, and then that's in my computer. So then if Bonnie's a friend of mine, she has access to your Wi-Fi access too? It seems a little odd in that sense.
It's
if you like his password, then I get to see it. If I'm not already in the network.
Exactly. Yeah, so if you're going to be upgrading to Windows 10, definitely take a look in the settings and choose yourself whether you want to be sharing your passwords on your social network.
Wow. Okay, so there are reasons to be careful about how we proceed with the technology.
Yeah.
That's true here on Earth, and it's also true as we go beyond the bounds of what we do. We've gotten some warnings from some very forward-thinking compendium of folks.
There's a wonderful letter, and it's an open letter, and it's to the makers of autonomous weapons. And this letter is at Future Life, futureoflife.org.
So there's an address for makers of autonomous
awesome,
weapons?
Isn't it? Basically, no, this is, well, there isn't. That's why you have to make an open letter, right? The general argument is that as we progress with all this artificial intelligence and such, and as we have problems, of course, on the sidelines with hacking and things, but as we move forward with autonomous vehicles that potentially will have weapons on them, mm-hmm. It's just a matter of time before a country releases an artificial intelligence weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about one of these drones. Like right now, the drones I mentioned earlier are controlled by a human being, and therefore the security protocols are at some level hopefully safe, and a human being makes the decision. If anything at this time is going to make a decision on who is going to die and who's going to live in battle, I would hope that it's at least as intelligent as a person. But there is a side effect that's not as great there. Humans don't have the kind of reflex controls that mm-hmm. machines do.
Mm-hmm.
A really good game artificial intelligence can kick your butt on any reflex game. It's not even a thought, right? Because by the time your brain's thought through the problem, by the time your brain's realized there is a problem, the computer could already have solved it.
Right.
So the reflex situation you'd want maybe a system that would be faster and better at targeting. So you'd take a vehicle, maybe a drone, and you'd fly it into a situation that would be combatants, and it would potentially figure out which combatants were on your side and which combatants were on the opposite side, and it would fire its weapons the ones that weren't. And it could probably do that pretty well, as we're seeing autonomous vehicles are getting really good, maybe even safer than human beings at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So you could think that having autonomous weapons could potentially be better than humans, but also the benefit is the human being on your side doesn't have to be there. So the call to action here is to ban all of this development, because the downside is great.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an arms race of artificial intelligence weapon-wielding vehicles, you have Skynet, like the Terminator movies, right? That idea of the end of days. Now, I think that all sides would be really good at being able to shut these things down, because it's one of the things you'd do right away. You'd pay attention to the stories, and you'd make sure that you could shut them down.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of making really highly specialized robots that kill should probably be stopped. Like, we should probably stop that. So this letter is an open letter. It's been signed by thousands of people, including people that we respect, like Elon Musk.
Elon Musk.
Yes. And also Hawking, Stephen Hawking.
We like that guy.
Yeah, definitely.
Yep.
Have all said that this is a bad idea. So, Brian, you see all see the downside. But do we see the upside of having autonomous weapons?
Of autonomous weapons? Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you were a country that's worried about aggressors, or you want to do targeted attacks.
And you're tiny but rich.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I see an incentive to make these, because mm-hmm. Everybody hates when you're using more bombs, weapons that are going to kill many, many people that are innocents. Why not make something that can target everything down to precisely the person?
Are we just going to make drones that fight other drones, and then those, like, a lot of debris falling down on us?
Well, wasn't there a Star Trek episode?
They will fight each other, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, when you make something like this, when you make a weapon that can then be hacked in by hackers, or can be use its own intelligence to go towards places that you might not have suspected, you're setting up a scenario that is just it's not going to be good.
So you think about that, AI developers.
First off, okay, one of the upsides is actually kind of the spoiler alert, kind of the through idea of Dr. Strangelove. Or Dr. Strangelove, is that the doctor in, what's the movie I'm thinking of?
I don't know. What's the plot line you're thinking of?
The plot line is you make a doomsday type weapon that uh-huh. detects nuclear Holocaust event and destroys the entire planet.
Yeah.
And you automate that system so that that's just going to happen. If anyone fires a nuclear weapon, you kill the planet.
Right.
That's
right.
Like everybody dies.
Mm-hmm.
And thereby you stop it, as long as you tell everybody about it.
Right.
So a small country could say, well, we put forth an autonomous system that will protect our borders no matter what, and we can't shut it off. So if you attack us, it's not like we're going to fight back. It's just going to happen, right? So there's a benefit in that logical gameplay idea. Of course, that movie. Do you guys remember the movie? I think
sure,
it's Dr.
Sure.
Strangelove.
Yeah, yeah, that's Dr. Strangelove.
Which is, of course, the problem in that story is that never told anybody they implemented the system. So.
Yeah, but of course, the problem back then was we didn't have hacks that people get into systems
and
take them over.
Well, see, you think of this as a problem because of the security and the vulnerability issue. I think if it's done excellently, if it's done perfectly, and we have no security vulnerabilities, it's still a horrible idea. And the reason is that if you give an artificial intelligence enough information to kill things, but you don't give it morals and ethics, you don't give it the soul aspect.
Then you don't give it enough to judge when to shoot and when not to shoot.
That's the problem. And that's actually why military in general is a is a difficult thing for an ethical person, because normally what you're doing is you're telling the people in the front line to kill. They don't think about it. They don't have the moral, you know, so it's very similar to that kind
of system. They're trained not to think about that aspect.
Because if they do think about it, they can't execute effectively. So of course a robot would do that better, right? You don't have to feed the robot. You don't have to worry about its psyche. But the idea of deploying machines to kill people, to me, is just abhorrent. I don't know if I've got a better argument than, ugh. But do you guys?
Yeah, here's a better argument. Let's say you do the AI just right, and the machine has moral judgment, and then it kills for you, and then it has a nervous breakdown.
Well, there is an idea of like getting its intelligence up to a level where it we have a second problem at that point, though. There's another problem at that point. But
The healthcare system is going to have to expand.
I guess what I'm saying is, even with a perfect system of this sort, I don't want to see us develop that. I don't want us to see the mechanization of killing people.
Right.
When we see that, we call that Holocaust, right? So I can't imagine a situation where it makes sense to do this, except that I think our militaries are doing this. This is what we're doing right now.
Well,
we're producing
the problem is we have the incentive to do it. So how do you change that incentive? How do you make the incentives keep us from doing that?
Well, you make laws about it, and you say none of us are going to do this. Kind of like we've done with chemical warfare, right? Like there are rules that we try to imply against nations, and this open letter is a calling to do just that. If you want to sign it, you're welcome to do so. We'll have a link from geekspeak.org.
And you are listening to geekspeak.org. We'll be right back. It's Geekspeak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and I'm speaking with Lyle Troxell and Brian Young, and we're getting into the nitty-gritty about the ethics of developing things that are scary. Speaking of things that are just coming out, recent developments, I hear Windows 10 is coming out. Did you say something about that, Brian?
Wait, is that supposed to be scary, too?
It's scary. It's kind of awesome. It's going to be a great update to the operating system.
I don't know why I'm ragging on it. I was a Windows user until very recently.
When we air, it'll actually have been out. It's released on July 29th.
Oh, that's right. It's a good point.
And it is going to be the best operating system Microsoft's made. Maybe.
Gosh, I hope so.
Well, you know, they do every other year, right? Or every other release.
That's been their pattern.
So like 98 was bad, ME was, all right, 98 was good, ME was bad, NT was good, Vista was bad. I'm trying to keep, I can't remember all the numbers, but 7
right?
was a pretty good operating system, Microsoft 7, the 7 version of Windows.
Yeah.
8 was a horrid and
so,
bad.
So let's be
and
fair.
And 10's good, going to be good again.
Let's be fair, every other releases, they try to do something really big.
Right, and it takes them 2 releases to do it.
Well, yeah, they go over the line. A lot of people say they went over the line with Windows 8.
So some of the things they're doing is they are bringing back the start bar. You can't get lost as badly as you could in
that
Windows
That will reassure 8. A lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they're doing a bunch of different things this time, including giving it away for free. And do you guys have a machine that has Windows 8 on it? Has it been asking you to sign up for the launch day release of Windows 10?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it asked me. Whenever I boot it. Of course, I haven't booted it in a long time. So,
good idea or bad idea?
Oh, it's just Nagware. They updated
it's
their
Nagware.
Own their own
it's
operating
free.
System.
It's free. Take it.
Now, the one thing to know is that they are going to be slowly scaling up the release of Windows 10. They're
what
not going to get
mean?
Microsoft. Well, they don't want to launch Windows 10 to everybody all at once. First off, you have to download it and run it. I mean, it has to install, and it's a download install. And therefore, if everyone did it at the exact same time, it would be a lot of network.
Oh, okay.
And therefore, they're going to roll it out slowly. But also, that means that if you don't get it right away, then the problems get handled by other people. So I personally like the idea of waiting on an operating system
You're not
update
be an early
for
adopter
at least 10
for this.
Days. There's no reason not to wait.
Yeah.
So if you do have the problem with this, though, is I recommend like you for this big release, turn off the auto updating of it. Mm. And then make sure to turn it back on
Ooh,
and do it later.
That's dangerous.
Know,
you're telling
know,
someone to not leave
well,
auto update on?
But that's what I would do.
No, that's what you would
Why?
Do.
Because if you are one of the few that have a serious problem, and your machine stops working, mm-hmm. it's better to have that happen when you are planning to have that happen versus just be surprised and 4 minutes before getting on Geekspeak, your machine goes down.
So I've got a better idea. Instead of telling the general public to turn off their auto-updating, which they could forget and then leave off for the next 3 years until why don't we just tell everybody, back up your machine. This is the time to back it up. This is out after Windows 10 was released?
Yeah, it's too late anyway. Hope it works out for you.
Well, you should be backing up anyways. Use this as a lesson.
Podcast listeners that listen to it beforehand, good luck. Don't update automatically. My point is that when a rollout happens automatically, That might happen 5 minutes before you're going to get on a flight. Like it has no
plan.
Inconvenient. Yeah, really good. Yeah. That's why it's better to plan it. So you can go, oh, it's Sunday morning. I could play with my machine all day while I'm doing other things around the house. And so that's why I kind of recommend you plan a little bit better. The other way to do it is have a second computer. I don't know. Maybe this is a good reason to have a Windows and a Mac. So when the Mac update happens and it crashes your machine, you've got a Windows machine, and hopefully it'll happen at the same
back
time.
Back and forth. Well, this is the beginning of forever and ever, right? Isn't this the last actual release that Windows is doing, and they're just going to be sort of updating as they go from here?
Yes. The idea here is that there won't be a Windows 11. There'll be Windows 10 rollouts continually, kind of like Apple did a long time ago with OS X. Mm-hmm. They have kind of a progressive upgrade.
Yeah, but eventually you get in the situation where it's really confusing, like you have OS X 11.
Yes.
Yeah, then what will they do?
I think that Microsoft plans to do this kind of like the browsers have done it, where there's kind of an infinite amount of Chrome browsers and Firefox browsers. But the truth is, an operating system is a little bit different. Yeah. So at some point, they're going to have to get something pretty fundamental change, and therefore they'll roll out a different version, kind of like Apple does as well.
But presumably that would also just be like, okay, here's the next thing. We called it something different.
Yeah, it should happen part of this update process automatically right before you get on a flight or start a radio show.
Yeah. So Windows, man, they're moving, shaking. They're doing some things.
They're doing some things. They're also doing some bad things. I mean, their Windows phone is not performing as well.
Oh,
I mean, I know they lost you this
last
year.
I left that thing behind months ago.
You left it behind, but it was a pretty cool interface, wasn't it?
I enjoyed it, I have to admit. I like the tiles. I like flipping around.
It seemed
to
be
really
smooth.
It was also my first smartphone, so I'm like, what? I can have a to-do list right here on my phone? You know,
pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, Windows Phone has Internet Explorer on Windows Phone. Internet Explorer is still around. It's kind of funny.
I thought it was dead.
Well, no,
oh,
Windows
no, it's
Phone
been
is still
renamed.
Around.
That's right.
Yeah. But Internet Explorer on the Windows Phone is still Internet Explorer on the Windows Phone. On OS, on Windows 10, it won't be called Internet Explorer. It'll be called something else. But that's not beside the point. This company, research firm called The Tipping Point, it's a division of HP. Basically, HP bought this research firm. Disclosed publicly 4 vulnerabilities in Internet Explorer running on a Windows Phone just recently. And they released those publicly to everybody because 6 months ago, they shared it privately with Microsoft. And Microsoft has done diddly to fix this problem.
What?
And so they finally kind of called it on publicly. And actually, it was 3 vulnerabilities 6 months ago and 1 November of last year. Is that longer than that? And in any case, Microsoft hasn't been responding. Microsoft did respond after they publicly announced these vulnerabilities because they're being shamed, which is, I guess, what has to happen, which is unfortunate. The idea of these of privately disclosing, like if Brian were to make a bug in one of his software, he's a great developer, so he wouldn't do this. But if he had a vulnerability and I was able to detect it, I wouldn't want to go tell everybody. I'd want to go tell Brian, hey, Brian, on the down low, I got a problem there. And then if Brian was a good developer, as he is, he'd say, oh, thanks. He'd fix it. Then he'd release the patch. Mm-hmm. Then, hopefully auto-updating it. Then we'd publicly talk about it. And that could be like, hey, how cool I am. I found this out. And everybody's happy. Nobody gets taken advantage of. Brian doesn't look bad. I don't look bad and all that. So unfortunately, companies don't do that very often, and Microsoft didn't. But their recent response is in the same vein of kind of
is it hilarious?
News. Yeah. Well, no, not that bad. Oh. We are aware of the reports regarding Internet Explorer for Windows Phone. A number of factors would need to come into play, and no attacks have been reported. We continue to monitor the situation and will take appropriate steps to protect our customers.
But we're not telling you what it is. You don't know if you've got it or not.
No, if you've got a Windows.
You don't know if they're going to do some shenanigans to your phone.
If you've got a Windows phone, you've got a vulnerability.
Honestly, I think they've watched Apple and the Mac for years and years and years. They thought, wow, they have not had the security problems we've had. Why is that? Oh, that's right. There's so few users. Okay.
That's so what we said
don't,
for years.
So we don't need to do this update because we have so few users on Windows phone.
That's just horrible.
That may or may not have been their logic.
Take appropriate steps to protect their customers. All they had to do is 6 months ago start working on the problem and release a patch, but they haven't.
Yeah.
The secondary problem would be that they don't always control the deployment of their software. Sometimes phone manufacturers do, or the carriers do.
Oh.
So there's a bit of a secondary problem there.
So maybe Microsoft was aware of the problem, but they couldn't get the phone folks to, the Nokia folks to do anything.
They would have had a better response in that situation. They would have said, we had the patch 6 months ago, but these companies, they would have blamed them.
Well,
they didn't. It was obviously their
It's really interesting, though. You'd think they'd jump on it. I mean, their platform, the biggest problem is they've been fighting to get apps to be made for the platform.
Right.
So you're going to be using the browser more than you might otherwise.
And updating to make sure things, work better is an important part of software deployment, right? Like Apple updated something recently, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I know this is going to become just that show where we start talking about updates. So, yeah, Apple actually didn't release this, but there is an update for the Apple 2GS. The Apple 2GS.
The 2GS?
The 2GS is like over 20 years old.
It's got a graphic user interface.
Wait, awesome. Isn't that one of those kind of like cathode ray tube ones?
The Apple II.
No, the Apple IIGS. It was the last of the Apple II line. It's before full color. Mac. It's got a mouse. It's got a whole GUI and uh-huh. and they fixed a whole bunch of things.
This is awesome. What operating system is it running?
It's 6.0.2.
Wow.
I mean, this is awesome. They've got the floppy disk for downloading and everything.
Who did this?
It's less than a mega floppy.
Who's they?
Okay. So there's a website. This is sort of a proof of concept. Somebody really loves their Apple IIGS, and they didn't like seeing it just languish there. So you can go to the website called callapple.org, mm-hmm. and they've got all the information about this update. And it's basically a hack to go in there, and they probably had to go in there with a hex editor and actually change the binary code to fix various things, like you can now navigate through folders with the command up arrow.
Cool. This is like feature improvement.
You've waited 20 years for a feature update. This is important. So anyways, for all of you 2GS lovers out there, go take a look. And just want to also note that this is the 30th anniversary of the Amiga, since we're talking about old computers.
The Amoeba?
The Amiga. Commodore Amiga, which was one of the first home computers you can do preemptive multitasking on. It ran smooth like butter.
Really? I hadn't heard of the Amiga. But it was produced by Commodore?
Yeah, it was awesome.
That was before the 64?
No, that was after this. Where was it in relation to
the PET computer?
I don't even remember the PET computer. This was a competitor for the Macintosh. It came out a few years after the Macintosh. Big thing is it had a graphics and sound coprocessor that other machines didn't have any extra equipment like that. So it could do sound and graphics like nothing else could at the time.
Oh. Did people use it for animation?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And in fact, Lightwave, I had a in school video toaster with Lightwave on it. We were doing all sorts of stuff with that. And our first personal animation recorder ran off of an Amiga. That was the first time I could actually see animation playback at full frame without putting it to, full speed.
Yeah.
Without putting it to videotape first.
Oh, nice.
You know, putting a frame to videotape one at a time is pretty slow.
Well, that's how it used to be.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Amiga made it better. That's fantastic. All right. So we have time for just one or two quick stories.
All right, quick story. Florida State University, Carrie Storhart and her colleagues have done a research project that looks at how good people are being distracted drivers. Mm. And basically, the long and the short of it is not even answering your text message or not even answering the phone, just getting an alert by your phone while you're driving can distract you.
That is the case.
Therefore, if you just have your car, your phone in the car,
yeah,
you're probably doing something that will set yourself up for failure. And they recommend turning off Do Not Disturb while you're driving.
That's a good idea because there's something about you hear the boot leap and then I gotta check that now.
Even if all you do is go, oh, should I answer it? That question is not glancing in the mirror, right?
Yeah, like it's wow.
See, this is what I don't get. Having a passenger, is that going to be just as distracting as having a phone? Or are we such a slave to our technology that just that little beep makes us lose our focus?
That's a good question.
Well, perhaps you've been in the situation, Brian, where you've got a really good conversation going in the car and you miss your exit.
Oh, I do that without anybody in the car.
Yes, a passenger's bad too. Basically, get rid of your phone and anyone who might be a passenger, and you might be okay as long as you don't talk to yourself in the car.
Brian, don't you have a cool web extra, something to look at?
So yeah, we were talking about space news earlier. This is not news, but this is really cool. Somebody has a video which basically makes a spirograph drawing out of a object that flew really close to Earth. They thought it was an asteroid at first back in 2002. But upon closer inspection, it was actually the third stage of the Apollo 12 mission that launched. And now what was cool about this is the way they set up that rocket launch is that the stage would go just orbiting around the sun forever and ever. But after 30 years, it came back around in 2002 and got caught in our gravity again. And this movie shows it spiraling around the Earth until finally it gets close to the moon, which ejects it back out into the solar system around the sun.
Cool.
It'll come back around.
Oh, is it going to come back?
They think it's going to come back around 2045-ish.
Fine. Okay, one more, Bonnie. One more, please.
Yeah, okay. What do you got? Yeah, what do you got?
Google Plus, you know, the social network by Google that doesn't go anywhere.
I'm aware of it.
And I think the tagline of Google Plus, if you work for Google. Yeah. Anyway, I use Google Plus sometimes, but I've been using it less and less,
yeah.
The social network. Recently, they had a lot of flack because they linked your YouTube account with your Google Plus account.
Oh.
And therefore, when you post a comment on YouTube, it gets posted on your feed on Google Plus. Google is deciding to decouple this, and they're going to disassociate Google Plus. So right now, you can't do anything. You can't like disconnect them right now because you'll delete your YouTube account. But in the future, it will become less and less important to connect those things, and therefore a little more interoperability between the services of Google.
But that's kind of good news, right? Because when you're trolling around on the YouTube comments, you don't want the people in your Google Plus network to know necessarily what trolly things you're saying.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
It would have been nice if it like competed with Facebook, though, I've got to say, because I think there should be more competition with Facebook.
But. Well, good luck to Google Plus. Brian, that movie you mentioned of the orbit.
The spirograph visualization.
Yeah. Oh, well, let's put that up on our website, geekspeak.org.
Yep. You can all go see it there.
Yeah, I want to see it. I think that's all the time we have for the show this week. So thank you for listening. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use our stuff any way you like. Just tell them Geek say hi. This is public radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit us at geekspeak.org. Email us at geeks@geekspeak.org and contact us on Twitter or at KUSP Geeks. Thanks so much for listening. I'm going to do the podcasty bit. Hey,
Why do that? Why do that?
Burp number two, also provided by Brian Young.
I didn't know that's the year started.
Oh. There's a great way to start the show. That was me. Monumental. Okay.